Okay, Y2K Goose Donald Bug bites us up.
That you pollute for the life that you have cost, for the good you prostitute, and for all that we have lost. Custer died for your sin. Custer died. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Now a new day must begin. Custer died. Custer died.
Any true Christian is going to be insulted by the comparison of that mass murdering psychopath with the Prince of Peace, but that's the exact point, because there is no bigger lie than that the third party died, that Rome murdered someone, and therefore I get my sins expunged. That's the most insane. Get me out of here, Tracy.
Oh, they tell me still time to save my soul. They tell me renounce all. All those material things you gain by exploiting other human beings. It's so more than you need. This is a dream to make you papa or make you queen. I won't die lonely, I have it all prearranged. Grave that's deep and wide enough for me and all my mountains. Oh, thanks. Oh, they tell me still time to save my soul. They tell me renounce all. Renounce all those material things you gain by exploiting other human beings. Mostly I blow only. Good, good people are. Good people are only my stepping stones. Gonna take all of my mountains, oh thanks, to surround me. Keep all my enemies away. Keep my sadness and loneliness at bay. The life I've always wanted, I never have. I'll be working for somebody else until I'm in my grave.
Okay. How about if not now?
can wait till morning comes. You can wait for the new day. You can wait and lose his heart. You can wait and soon be sorry. If not now, then when? If not today, then why make your promises? Hey, love declared for days to come is as good as none. Love's the only thing that's free. We must take it where it's found. Pretty soon it may be costly. If not now, then when? If not today, then why make your promises? Hey, love declared for days to come is as good as none. If not now, thinking the moment has arrived. If not now, then when?
I'm from Tracy's 88 Open Coliseum concert. Now, I was gonna bounce around to some bad news and horror. So sorry, kids, but you know how we are here. Monsters Horror, 104.1 FM, and maybe this will.
But with the other deputy director, Richard Bissell, were dismissed by JFK when he discovered it had been a bait and switch. There had been no expectation that this ragtag band was actually going to succeed. The agency had already discovered that the Soviet Union had learned the date of the invasion and had notified Castro. So Castro, the Soviet Union, and the CIA all knew. Castro knew we were coming. The only key person who did not know was John F. Kennedy, who undoubtedly would have called it off. So that we're in the fascinating situation that for years and years we were unable to obtain the W-2 forms for the alleged assassin of the President of the United States. They only became available after they developed sufficient technology to fake it and then release it, because otherwise discovering he'd been paid $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination would have blown his cover. He would have no longer been a plausible candidate as the patsy.
Now, the number 179 is easy to remember because it's one short of 180, which is what happened when the Dixiecratic LBJ blew the brains out of Kennedy level. My friend Jim Wilcott published in 1989 Stray Magazine, JFK Assassination, the CIA Insider's View. And there he says the plan was to have Oswald linked to Castro and he would be the patsy to give a green light for the invasion. That's the basic Northwoods operation. He also talks at the forum we went over with Paul Berdino, and he talked about the CIA's germ warfare program, his wife Elsie's cancer death from the virulent form that takes, like, you know, not months to kill you, but days or weeks. But anyway, the thing about that is Judith Barry Baker was flying back from Texas or no, no, she was hosting the this year's 54th anniversary of having our brains blown out after driving past the Patsy. Of course, they land on the back of the vehicle. A five-year-old knows that the brains will be knocked in the direction of the projectile. Therefore, it was not from the school book depository where Oswald had been posted. Of course, the W-2 forums would have shown $200 a month. And so in this week's Guns and Butter, Bonnie's talking with Jim Fetzer, who's a veteran, and he's sort of a right-winger, ex-Marine and all that, but, you know, they take it personally when their commander is murdered as blatantly as that with a magic bullet, explaining, you know, that we did it, immediately announcing the absence of the conspiracy, explaining that LBJ is the finger on the trigger.
Now, Jim, another question about that U-2 flight. Now, that was when Eisenhower was president, right?
Yeah.
And a friend of mine has done a lot of research on this, and he says that Eisenhower wanted to have a rapprochement or some kind of a detente with the Russians.
Which, of course, the whole plot is to, and whether it was the empty gas or Oswald giving them the altitude so that they would know, because the radar doesn't work that good, so you know when to have the thing blow up. You can send it in direction of this point, but our sophistication wasn't that great back then, so knowing the exact altitude will let you boom. So either way, so introducing this other possibility, Fletcher Prouty is a pretty credible source, blah, blah, blah.
And that sending these U-2s over there, I can't remember the story exactly, but maybe...
But maybe that's why Gary Power died in one of those crashes, because he mentioned Oswald had a high security clearance at the Atsugi Air Base in Japan, where Jim Wilcott was told, oh, by the way, you made a pay voucher out for that project. And he forgot the code cryptonym, but of course, at the time, it was familiar, and that was the Oswald project. They were talking about sending this spy into, and of course, he had been sheep-dipped, which was parading with Cruz, the relative, perhaps. Anyway, that's Trump's little thing. Never mind.
That Eisenhower had stopped the U-2 flights, but they continued them, and they had this U-2 go down over that it was Dulles that defied Eisenhower. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, I think that story is very, very plausible, that the agency was resisting control. In fact, when Jack... one of the motives for taking out Jack, I mean, it was inspired by Lyndon's desire to accede to the presidency, in which position he could control the subsequent course of events. He would appoint his close friend and ally, Edgar, the FBI, as the sole investigative agency to cover it up, where the FBI never even questioned the 10 closest witnesses to the limousine. Others nearby weren't asked the crucial questions to reveal the important information they had, and if by some chance it got into the transcript, they simply edited it out. Dulles, no doubt, was playing games behind the scene and resisting. Jack was putting the covert ops of the CIA under the control of the Pentagon to curtail the agency. Neither liked that. The Joint Chiefs were upset because he'd not invaded Cuba, contrary to the unanimous recommendation. He'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to their unanimous opposition. Now he was going to pull our forces out of Vietnam, where they felt a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. The agency has been a renegade for all too long, Bonnie. It's been a travesty, committing coups and assassinations around the world, more than 80 in number. Most Americans first became aware of Iran in relation to the embassy hostage crisis, which William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, manipulated to the detriment of Jimmy Carter. They knew that if the hostages were to be released before the election, that Carter would win in a walk. So they negotiated arms for hostages on the grounds that the Iranians not release the hostages until after the inauguration, which was exactly how it played out. But most Americans think this was some overt act by the Iranians that was just unjustified or unwarranted, when in fact the CIA had executed its first coup abroad in Iran in 1953, carried out by Kermit Roosevelt, who was a cousin of Teddy. to take out the democratically elected government of Iran and replace it with a dictatorial figure, the Shah. We have done this in many other countries. Our pretensions to be promoting democracy and freedom are ludicrous. Consider that our efforts to take out Bashar al-Assad from Syria. Most Americans to this day do not understand that Assad is the democratically elected president of Syria, and he's supported by 80% or more of the Syrian people, a far greater popularity than our current president or even most of our most recent. So, you know, the hypocrisy of the United States, this is also manifest in 9/11, which was an orchestrated event that was brought to its complements of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. The objective was to instill fear into the American people to support wars in the Middle East, to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region, and eventually to confront the Persian nation of Iran. Wesley Clark revealed the agenda when he gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in 2007, revealing the plan to take out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. It did not play out that way because of the intervention of Russia with the support of Iran. ISIS forces, which, believe it or not, Bonnie, we created. ISIS was created by the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012 with the support of John Brennan, the director of the CIA, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State at the time, and Barack Hussein Obama, president. Michael Flynn, who was the head of the DIA, opposed the creation of ISIS, and because of that, John Brennan recommended to Barack Obama that he ought to fire Michael Flynn, which was done.
And, of course, that's why the weight of the MSM is coming down on him.
As many of you know, Nathan Rothschild caused a sell-off in bonds and gave all the traders who looked to him for guidance the impression that the French had won at Waterloo. The other traders also rushed to sell their bonds, causing a 95% decline in their original worth. And once the bottom had dropped out, Nathan Rothschild then rebought as many bonds back as he could at hugely discounted prices, and in doing so, he multiplied his wealth 20 times in just 3 days of trading. Now, that history was shared in the 1934 Hollywood movie, The House of Rothschild, which was backed by the Rothschild family.
Of course, that's translated today as the Rockefellers, because they're married, although they don't have the religious trappings, and yet it's the family wealth. So Rockefeller is business partners with Bush, and guess who bought out Dresser Industries when there were those billions of liabilities and asbestos? Of course, it was Dick Cheney's. Well, that's thrown in there too. Anyway, Dresser Industries was bought by Halliburton. So you see how the vice president is like feathering the nest of the son of Hitler's banker, the father of the grandson of Hitler's banker is W. So let me just get back to the title here, Y2K Bugs Bites SF. So over next door, we've got the Millennium Tower falling over because there was a big hole next to it from what was supposed to be the rapid rail, okay, that never happened because the bankers took all the money home right before handing off to the first black president, September 15th. George Herbert Walker, or they're around there, is emailing, what have you guys been smoking down there? Because the lawyers say, well, if the presidents take all the money home at that $1 trillion company that folded, Lehman Brothers. Oh, yeah, that's where the grandmothers from Big Mountain were in WTC7, the third skyscraper to implode into thermite-laden rubble weeks later because they had the so-called deed to their grandfather's graves and mothers. So the bulldozers would haul up their bones. Baba Gay saw her grandfather's bones bulldozed for the Peabody coal mine, but...
Bye. Bye. Yes, bye.
Government, which ultimately gave him English government. Therefore, the taxes the citizens paid were going to pay the 8% interest that the English government had to pay to borrow the money. So, the Battle of Waterloo occurred in 1815. So let's just round up the quote-unquote control of the Bank of England by the Rothschilds to 1817, since we're in the year 2017, giving us a nice round number of 200 years to work with. And we're going to do the math in just a second, but I want
Well, anyway, that goes up to the Balfour Declaration. Now, of course, it was a deal between Baron Walt and, the German Baron with all these trillions, and the Lord that denied, and Lord means off with their heads, who denied sanctuary during the pogroms, Balfour. So this is supposedly going to be, I better shut up before I puke. Let me jump back to False Flag Weekly News.
Evidence-based analysis of what actually happened at Las Vegas on October the 1st, 2017.
Are told in this mainstream report that Farrakhan has once again, quote, repeated.
Does address these big issues in a way that could advance the principles of world peace if these issues were taken more seriously.
You know, I wish we had more religious leaders who were inspired by the Holy Spirit to speak truth to power as intensely and eloquently as Minister Farrakhan does.
Oh, fuck you. Excuse me. Sorry. Shouldn't say that.
Okay. Trump administration madness. That's a popular category here. We have a deranged Ponzi scheme for a Trump tax plan. Is it that bad? Well, it's a big payoff to the rich guys who elected Trump. They're going to end, according to this plan anyway, they'll end the federal tax deduction for state taxes, local taxes, property taxes. So that means that a huge pile of money gets transferred from rich guys or people with property in the high property tax states, like Wisconsin, to the same category of people, the rich guys, in the low property tax states like Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and places that voted for Trump.
Well, that's one aspect of this, but the larger framework is a reduction in taxes to corporations.
We still have a couple of stories analysis this week. And, okay, 9/11 fallout. Here we have American and United settling with Larry Silverscum. That's right. Larry, the overinsured landlord of 2 months of the Trade Center, he doubled the insurance and then walked away with a massive payout, redoubling it by calling it double indemnity, two separate and unrelated terrorist attacks, the two airplanes. He's made his last settlement in the court of who else? Judge Alvin Hellerstein, the ultra-Zionist with family in it, pioneer family of Israel. That's the judge that all of the 9/11 litigation has been funneled through, and he used mafia tactics to force everybody to settle and sign non-disclosure agreements so none of the victims' families can ever sue the people who really did 9/11. And here we have Larry, who made his pile on this mass murder, getting his last nearly $100 million. How can this guy still be alive?
Well, Silverstein, he... As I believe the story goes, he acquired some kind of title in the World Trade Centers just weeks before 9/11 happened. He immediately insured the buildings for terrorism, for a double act of terrorism, since two towers came down initially and then Building 7. So he made billions on that. And here's another $100 million, a little chump change, I guess, for him to pick up from, get this, American Airlines, United, something called Continental Holdings, the whole thesis being that these airlines erred. They were negligent in allowing these hijackers to take control of the planes, that they have some liability for what transpired. So they're handing over $100 million approximately to Larry Silverstein recognition that they screwed up on 9/11.
That's on top of a lot of money he's already collected, including $4.5 billion in the initial double indemnity settlement. Yeah. He only put up something like $15 million of his own money, and then he had another $100 million from his backers. So that was one of the biggest windfalls in all of history. Talk about insurance fraud, talk about conspiracy to mass murder. And then he went on television and confessed to having demolished his own building, Building 7, which in fact he collected $750 million for. Man, we have to move on because I'm going to get too angry, Tony. Next slide. Oh, this makes me angry too, though. The attacks on Muslims, Islamophobic attacks in the U.S., more than doubled last year. It's also more than double the post 9/11 level, 2001. And then over in Afghanistan, the war that will never end, that was based on the false premise of 9/11. Is continuing, and now they're pretending to fight the very drug industry that is the main reason for the U.S. invasion in the first place.
Well, the stats that I picked up, there were 33 episodes, anti-Muslim episodes counted in 2007, 127 this year. So a vast increase, higher than the number of incidents in 2001. So this use of false flag terrorism that we're alleging, that we argue in different ways, the direct connection to Islamophobia and the exercise of violence and repression and suppression and ethnocentrism towards Muslim people, the evidence is overwhelming that this trend, you know, it's far too dominant in our society.
And what else did we get from 9/11 besides an endless heroin war in Afghanistan, massive Islamophobia, 32 million Muslims murdered in a global genocide? We also got massive surveillance everywhere you go. Airports are now a dystopian nightmare, and Delta wants to make it even worse by bringing in biometric surveillance, and they're spending millions and millions of dollars hawking the wonderful new biometric surveillance that's going to essentially be following everybody around every time they step in an airport.
Well, I think it's going to be stepping into a lot more venues than airports. I think it's going to be kind of a permanent thing everywhere we go.
Okay, well, we got to whip through these last couple of stories extra fast. We're about at the end of our hour. Here's the coup in Zimbabwe overthrowing Mugabe. I've got to talk to Andrei Volchek about that. He says everything we're hearing about that country is BS. Bleep Trump sticker, who's now bleeping the sheriff who pulled her over because he didn't like her having an anti-Trump bumper sticker.
Well, let's just zoom along and okay, get to the finish line.
Well, then the Navy pilots are zooming through the sky, skywriting obscene, vulgar drawings, and they're being dressed down for that. This was a plane, an electronic warfare plane from the Naval Air Station at Whidbey Island in Washington that drew, it quote, created skywritings in the shape of male genitals. So they are now being dressed down. The Navy says this was wholly unacceptable, antithetical to Navy core values, such as mass murdering people by dropping bombs on them. And the Navy apologizes for this irresponsible and immature act. Anyone who was offended by this unacceptable action, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess if you're in the, you know, U.S. Armed Forces or the Secret Sky Crew or whatever, you should never draw male genitals in the sky. Instead, you should spew aluminum, barium, and strontium nanoparticles as in this picture.
Well, there it is, another episode of False Flag Weekly News.
54 years later, by Mujahid Kamran, a brilliant article. He's a Pakistani physics professor who's going through some of the same problems that you've had, Tony, for the same reasons. He tells too much truth, and the same forces are trying to shut him down. Anyway, he's not shutting himself up by any means. This is a fantastic analysis of the JFK assassination coming from Pakistan.
Indeed. To me, the elephant in the room of this analysis concerns something called Majestic 12. Kamran goes as far as to say that UFOs.
He's citing Michael Sala.
Michael Sala.
Yeah, yeah. But he's bringing that into the mix and saying we need to look at this.
Yeah, and the idea that Roswell in 1947 was actually what it professes to be, that there has been a lot of reverse engineering getting new technologies. I mean, this is a forbidden subject. It's a, you know,
it's forbidden.
This,
we can't talk about it anymore.
Can't talk about it, but I will bring up the fact that the Disney Corporation, Michael Eisner, introduced a show in 1995, a Disney documentary explaining the UFO involvement in U.S. military, explaining Roswell, explaining this message going out to the universe when atomic weapons were blasted, which apparently has resonances in many parts of the universe.
That what it goes there for is to unlock the door. It goes around and criticize and sleep. Through a fractal not a breaking wall, I see you, my friend, and touch your face again. Miracles will happen as we trip.
Thank you.
That was quite something, but you know, I think I should sing one of your songs.
Well, which one do you want to sing?
Someone found a letter you wrote me on the radio, and they told the world just how you felt, and must have fallen out of a hole in your own brown overcoat. They never said your name. I knew who they meant. Oh,
I was so surprised and shocked, and I wondered too if by chance you'd heard it for yourself. I never told the soldiers how I've been feeling over you, but they said it really loud. They said it on the air, on the radio.
Whoa,
on the radio.
Whoa,
on the radio.
Whoa,
on the radio.
Place of those kinds of approaches, I would like to put forward an entirely different perspective. In order to illuminate the history of the past century in Palestine, as the Palestinians have experienced it, and I would argue as most people in the formerly colonized world also see it, and that's most people in the world. I hope thereby to provide a richer understanding of the real conflict over that land today. Now, from this perspective, the one that I want to use this evening, the period since the Balfour Declaration of November 29, 1917, has witnessed what amounts to 100 years of war against the Palestinians. Like many other long-lasting wars, this one has had long periods of apparent calm, interspersed with paroxysms of violence. However, this war had a unique nature. It was formally sanctioned and authorized by the greatest powers of the day at different times over the past century. Indeed, this war could not have taken place without them, but it was mainly waged by others. I'm going to repeat that sentence. This war was formally sanctioned and authorized by the greatest powers of the day at different times over the past century. Indeed, this war could not have taken place without them, but it was mainly waged by others. An important feature of this long war, one which has been much distorted, has been the Palestinians' continuing resistance against heavy odds to what amounts to one of the last ongoing attempts at colonial subjugation in the modern world. Taking this approach is not in any way to chronicle the history of the Palestinians as one of their victimization. Indeed, it gives them full agency as people resisting a long campaign to remove them from their land and from history. Nor is it to whitewash the many grievous mistakes of Palestinian leaders. As I wrote in The Iron Cage, much of the history of the Palestinian people must be understood in terms of the very bad choices made by their leaders at different times, albeit often in the most difficult of circumstances. What the people of Palestine experienced as a continuous war against them since 1917 is still underway today. It thereby constitutes a global anomaly. All the other recent wars to uproot colonial settler regimes in the second half of the 20th century, whether this was in Algeria or southern Africa or elsewhere, finally ended with the defeat of these regimes. This has not happened in Palestine. Instead, in Palestine, Israel has thus far been highly successful in forcibly establishing itself both as a colonial reality and as a powerful nation state in a post-colonial age. It has done this while always assuming a false posture of self-defense, which I'm sure will be familiar to most of you. The great historian and theoretician of colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, who sadly just passed away, wrote the following. I'm quoting Patrick Wolfe. Settler colonies were, in brackets are, premised on the elimination of the native societies. The split tensing, were, are, the split tensing reflects a determinate feature of settler colonization. The colonizers come to stay. Invasion is a structure, not an event. He's thinking, of course, of Australia. You could say the same thing about New Zealand. You could say the same thing about Canada or the United States. But think of those words in regard to Palestine. In Palestine, both that structure and the war that resulted from it are still ongoing today after 100 years. It is a war that seems endless to the Palestinians themselves. Now, there have been repeated authoritative international pronouncements that amounted to declarations of war by the great powers that were sponsors of this long colonial campaign against the Palestinians. The first of these was issued in November of 1917, November 2nd to be exact, on behalf of the British Cabinet by Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour, the Balfour Declaration. British troops were then in the process of conquering Palestine. They occupied Jerusalem a couple of weeks afterwards, on December 9th of 1917. The Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations mandate that was later granted to Britain on the basis of this declaration, and which repeated the terms of the declaration in the preamble to the mandate verbatim, this declaration and this mandate arrogated national rights in Palestine exclusively to Jews, who were at that time, of course, a tiny minority of the population. It thereby denied the national existence and political rights of the vast Arab majority of Palestine's people. So the Balfour Declaration and the mandate said that there is one people in Palestine. There's one group with national rights. Neither the declaration nor the mandate ever named this population, which had lived in its own country for generations. So the word Arab or Palestinian doesn't occur in the Balfour Declaration. It doesn't occur in the mandate for Palestine. The Balfour Declaration has been considered historically in terms of various paradigms, mainly in terms of Zionist or British considerations, and there has been good work on both of these sides of it. However, it was in fact a quintessentially colonial proclamation by the greatest power of its day of that power's intent to replace an indigenous people with another people whom it proposed to bring into existence on that indigenous people's territory. For two decades, without fail, actually for 22 years, without fail, Britain carried out to the letter the terms of the Balfour Declaration and of the League of Nations mandate that defined and regulated British rule over Palestine while embodying and amplifying the terms of the Balfour Declaration. In keeping with the mandate, Britain supported Zionist immigration and land purchase and granted self-governing institutions and international diplomatic status to the Jewish minority. A para-state was created under the mandate by the terms of the mandate, while self-government and diplomatic status were refused to the Arab majority. Provoked by Britain's denial of their rights and indeed of their very existence as a people, the Palestinians belatedly rebelled in 1936 to 1939. They briefly liberated some towns and parts of the countryside, but the British Empire responded ruthlessly, employing over 100,000 troops and extensive air power to crush this uprising. In the process, the British killed, wounded, deported, or imprisoned 10% of the adult male population of Palestine. They also confiscated large quantities of weapons. They exiled or jailed most leaders and executed a very large number of them. This was the delayed military implementation of Britain's original 1917 declaration of war on the Palestinian people. I have stressed in what I've said so far the role of Britain, and it's important that you keep your mind on that because I'm going to follow up with a similar stress on other powers. Now, as any historian can tell you, the same dates, the same events, the same individuals can have a completely different valence for different people. There are battles that mean one thing to one group and something else to another group. Thus, for Israelis, Arthur James Balfour is a hero. There are streets named for him in Israeli cities. There's a town named for him, in fact. And the promulgation of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 is an occasion for celebration in Israel. Balfour is obviously not a hero to the Palestinians. Why this was so can be understood from a close textual analysis of a number of key documents from this era, starting from the Balfour Declaration, which defined British policy really for the entirety of the mandate period. This declaration, as I've noted, says that there's only one people with national rights in Palestine, the Jewish people. The Palestinians are, as I've said, described not by name or even as Arabs, but only as, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. So 94% of the population, never named, are not given national rights, and are described only as the existing non-Jewish population. This vast majority of Palestine's population is only guaranteed civil and religious rights. They are not guaranteed political rights, and they are not guaranteed national rights. So there's one community with national rights, and the right to a para-state and other legal protections. Another community is simply given civil and religious rights. So that's the first document, which I've already talked about. Second, which I haven't talked about, is Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. This was issued in June 1919, and it described the Arab peoples of the regions of the former Ottoman Empire as independent nations. You would think, well, that means Palestine. It didn't mean Palestine. This Article of the Covenant, Article 22, which supposedly governed the entire mandate system, was consistently interpreted, both by Britain and by the League of Nations, to exclude Palestine. This did not apply to Palestine in the view of the British. In other words, Article 22, as far as Balfour and his colleagues were concerned, guaranteed self-determination to all Arab peoples who had formerly been part of the Ottoman Empire, but not to the Palestinians. Because Palestine's self-determination was promised to the Jewish people.
Actually standing up for the principles for which a constitution is supposed to stand. He's received a very bad press from a media that is almost completely under the influence of the CIA. In fact, William Colby, in 1975, in testimony to Congress, explained that the agency owns everyone of significance in the media. At that time, there was no distinction between the mainstream and the alternative media, where his revelation was followed by Carl Bernstein's publication in Rolling Stone in 1977, entitled The CIA and the Media, where he reported that high officials of the agency were boasting that their greatest successes had been with Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS. If you controlled Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS in that era, you virtually had a lock on the American news, and today the situation is overwhelmingly worse.
Well, that's exactly right, Jim. And I found out from my friend Barbara Honaker at the Dallas conference that the famous quote from William Casey, she was in the meeting taking notes, and she is the source of William Casey's famous quote when he's asked by Ronald Reagan how he wanted to run his department and what he wanted to accomplish for the future. Quote, Casey said, "Our aim is that as soon as when the American public believes everything that the American public believes is false, we will know that we have accomplished our job," something to that effect.
That's right. That's right. He said, and Barbara Honegger confirms, that our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false. I mean, isn't that stunning, Bonnie? The American people believe the government is there to benefit us, to keep us informed, to look out for our best interests. But actually, the situation is something more like the opposite, as difficult as that may be to believe.
Now, Jim, it's at 1:46. We've got like maybe 10, 11.
I'm quoting from this memo. Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes of far greater import than the desires. You almost want to hear the mere desires, but he didn't say mere. Than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now, just for the moment, inhabit that land, that ancient land. Balfour went on to say, I quote again, in Palestine, and this follows from what he just said, in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country.
As his last confession, that the chain of command went from Lyndon Johnson to Cord Meyer, to David Attlee Phillips, to William Harvey, and then to David Sanchez Morales. Now, below David, I believe, were the mechanics, their supervisors and coordinators, meaning the actual shooters, who I certainly agree included Frank Sturgis. He appears to have fired the shot that entered Jack's right temple. It was a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium, because he'd previously been hit in the back of the head by a shot fired by an anti-Castro Cuban, Nestor Tony Escadro, from the room closet window of a uranium mining company in the Daltex that was owned by or controlled by the CIA and or the Mossad.
Now, of course, Frank Sturgis, a.k.a. Fiorini, is one of those filmed under arrest with E. Howard Hunt at Dealey Plaza. And George H.W. Bush was filmed there. But when I say Y2K Gusama bug bites San Francisco, of course, the white anti-Castro Cubans, a.k.a. Gusanos, were rampaging through the election counting in the first Jim Crow coup. So the Y2K bug, there was all this hysteria. Do we count the zero? Will the computers know what time it is? Blah, 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 blah. Well, the real color line was, the real Y2K bug was that in December of 2000, Henry Kissinger says, the only thing that can keep this country together is an act of domestic terrorism. This is after Choice Point stripped 90,000 black votes from the Florida rolls. It was the first of two Jim Crow coups, Ohio, the same kind of thing, but you had Trader Carey, you had the middleman business, and Mark Connell dying after testifying about that, along with Stephanie Tubbs Jones from the same state. She had challenged the Jim Crow coup 4 years before, so.
Now, it's fascinating. But Richard Hook has done brilliant work that supports the conclusion that George H.W. Bush was actually in the book depository supervising the three shots that were made with a Mannlicher Carcano. These were the only shots made with an unsilenced weapon, Bonnie, to create the acoustical impression of only three shots having been made. I agree with most of the analysis, but I doubt very much that they used any foreigners. Texans would have regarded Frenchmen as pansies. They wouldn't have thought they would follow through. Now, Antonio Veciana, fascinatingly enough, was actually captured in a famous photograph by a Dallas photographer and is captured in the right-hand corner of a color photograph on the cover of my first book, Assassination Science, which I only discovered in following the issue about Rafael Cruz having been in New Orleans in front of the trademark when Lee Oswald was handing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets. It was indeed Rafael Cruz, who was indeed the father of Ted Cruz, who was indeed an anti-Castro Cuban, who was indeed in Dallas at the time. And for him to have been there, but also been with Antonio Veciana of Alpha 66, among the most vicious of the anti-Castro organizations, on Main Street together just before the vehicle turned from Maine onto Houston, indicates to me conclusively that he was on the fringe of the assassination. He was certainly not a shooter. But Donald Trump was widely ridiculed for making the point that Ted Cruz's father was there with Lee Harvey Oswald. We have long since confirmed that to be the case.
You're listening to author and researcher James Fetzer. Today's show, the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Sampled on the Mouse Report, 104.1 FM, Berkeley Liberation Radio, .info.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, Jim, I want to ask you about a person that comes up in the afterword of St. John Hunt's book, that afterword written by Eric Hamburg, and he talks at length about Richard Helms of the CIA, Richard Helms, who was appointed DCI by LBJ once LBJ became president. He seems to be in the shadows of this whole assassination. Do you have any information on him?
Oh, Helms knew what was going on. There's no doubt about that. The fact is that Alan Dulles, whom JFK would retire with great fanfare, no doubt played a role in planning the assassination, but the pivotal player was Lyndon Johnson, who forced himself onto the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960. He would bottle up any legislative proposal set down by the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way out of this, but Lyndon had them boxed in, and they had to accede to his demand to be Jack's running mate. When one of Winston's wealthy supporters heard this, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing because now LBJ was going to help JFK become president. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare that Jack would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. Lyndon Johnson would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination after he had convinced Jack that he needed to travel to Texas to mend fences between warring Democratic factions there.
Wow, that's really something. And as well, in E. Howard Hunt's memo to his son, St. John, he states that the assassination was initially to take place in Miami, but that Lyndon Johnson changed the location to Dallas, citing, quote, personal reasons. Do you know anything about this?
Well, there were two plots that were exposed. The Miami was circumvented by transporting JFK in a helicopter instead of a motorcade. The Chicago event was actually undermined by a report from an FBI informant by the name of Lee, who appears to have been Lee Oswald, who Bonnie not only was recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence when he was a recruit at San Diego, where I subsequently would be a series commander with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command going through the training cycle, but he would be stationed at Atsugi, our most secure base in Japan from which the U-2 overflights were taking place. No one would be stationed there unless their loyalty was absolute. He made a pseudo-defection to the Soviet Union, apparently to provide the information about the altitudes. A summit meeting was forthcoming between Eisenhower and Khrushchev when Khrushchev accused the United States of spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denied it, but Khrushchev was able to produce the pilot, Gary Francis Powers, and parts of the U-2, which they'd been able to shoot down, which, of course, led to the termination of the summit plans and an increase in Cold War tensions instead of a reduction. When Lee returned to the United States after marrying the nurse of the niece of a KGB colonel, he wasn't received as a traitor to the United States, but was greeted by a CIA front organization, which gave him money to relocate to New Orleans himself, while Marina went to Dallas and was residing with the Payne family, Michael and Ruth, who had ties to the CIA, unbeknownst to them. Ruth would subsequently be instrumental in getting Lee a position at the book depository just 2 weeks before the motorcade. In the meanwhile, in New Orleans, he was being sheep-dipped by giving a phony persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer in order to set him up for the role of the patsy in Dallas, which is why he was handing out those pamphlets in front of the trademark in the company of Rafael Cruz.
Could you talk a little bit more about the U-2? Now, supposedly that was shot down, but I had some information from someone else that indicated the tank was only half full and it went down on its own.
Well, that's very good, Bonnie. Apparently, the Soviets had been trying to shoot down, but they didn't know the altitude and couldn't succeed.
So, let's go to the horse's mouth here. JFK assassination and a CIA insider's view. CIA was coming of age, developing into a sophisticated disciplined corps of specialists. Technical Services Division was beefed up. Bizarre and esoteric techniques were developed through the use of chemistry, photography, graphics, psychology, and particularly electronics. Computer sciences were widely applied on an enormously expanded scale. At Tokyo Station, this was manifested in a great clamping down. At lower levels, we saw it in the form of speed-up. Jobs were cut, leaving offices shorthanded, requiring us to work harder. Allowances for housing, rugs, drapes, and personal vehicle mileage, reimbursements, etc., were more carefully audited. Housing, in particular, was not the juicy fringe extra it formerly was. Now, this is under Kennedy, that's DJ Monster Fight. There was much grumbling about jobs being filled by outsiders rather than promotions from within. In operations, greater reliance on deep cover assets outside the station cut into the more sensitive projects that brought the higher promotions. Sweeping changes in the encryption and coding system made more work for everyone. More strict enforcement of security compartmentalization, need to know, were imposed. Security violations became more serious. Fun and games that were formerly a fringe benefit, with booze, women, and expensive nightclubs in the guise of operational necessity, were not as easy to pull off. Safe houses were more restricted to operational uses. Criticism and earshot of supporters became unwise. These were developments that occurred from the invasion fiasco to November 23, 1963. With the assassination came more criticism and talk outside the confines of the need-to-know principle, especially after a few drinks away from the station to let off steam. Lee Harvey Oswald was a favorite subject. He had been trained at Atsugi Naval Air Station, a plush super-secret cover base for Tokyo Station's special operations. As I understood it, SR Branch had the responsibility for it with much special expertise and direction from headquarters. The U-2 flights that originated from there were a major project of CIA. Chief of Station William V. Broe, B-R-O-E, and later Pete Wheeler also supervised it closely. Oswald was recruited from the military for the express purpose of becoming a double agent, assignment to the USSR. It was said they had some kind of special handle on him. Maybe his mob uncle Dutch. Anyway. Perhaps, went the speculation, they had discovered he had murdered someone or committed some other serious crime during a routine lie detector test. In any case, it was a very risky assignment. CIA taught him Russian, and it was said he had been to the farm, CIA agent training camp Perry, Virginia, although probably not in one of the regular agent training programs. He may not have even known that he had been there. that was often done in very special cases. They would be put to sleep and wake up in a strange place and be told it was someplace other than the farm. Although they said that he knew he was working for the CIA, he was kept rigidly compartmented from any of the normal contacts that a regular CIA employee would have. Oh, yeah. Jim thought it was when he was in the Army, joined in the 50s, he was told, oh, you'll be working with the CIA. He thought it was a labor organization. And he thought they snagged the couple because of his wife's brains. The first woman to testify against them. Okay. The operational people that I knew never admitted they were working on the project, although some hinted at it. Jerry Fox, an SR agent who purchased Soviet information, may have been one of them. The deputy chief of SR, first name was Dave, I forget his last name, may also have been one, too. We went drinking once in Shinjuku with a small group of other people. More than once, I was told something like, so-and-so was working on the Oswald project back in the late 50s. Unquote. Conversations with the SR people were not numerous. However, very few took place and were short. While support, Korea branch, China branch, and Japan branch people talked more, SR was quite tight-lipped about it. This was once offered as proof that there was such an SR project. It was, also, not a topic of continual or loose discussion or chatter. I was somewhat cautious in talking about it, except with my closest friends, and then always away from the building. Some others would say this was a subject that was better not discussed. It was said they had many difficulties with Oswald, the exact nature of which has been forgotten. Critics said it was a stupid project from the start. They should have known the Soviets would never buy the story. He was a poor subject for such a deep cover operation. There were too many compromising facets to his background, which would make it a difficult story to sell. When Oswald returned from the USSR in June of 62, either on his way back or after he got back, he was brought back to Japan to either Atsugi or Yokosuka for debriefing, it was assumed. At one point, soon after Ruby shot Oswald, I was talking with someone, I can't recall for whom, for sure, and I expressed disbelief about Oswald even being a CIA project. I was told something like, well, Jim, so-and-so drew an advance sometime in the past from you for Oswald or for that project under such and such a crypto. It was a familiar cryptonym to me at the time, which I have since forgotten, as well as the time that the advance of funds were drawn. Among the close circle of friends with which I discussed all this openly, there was no doubt that Ruby was paid by CIA to do away with Oswald, and Oswald was a patsy. Information from other rather tight social circles would occasionally come our way, and we would seize upon it and try to fit it into our own version of the scenario. There was no doubt CIA was in thick as thieves with Dallas police. Several different individuals or firms in Dallas had been involved in one way or another with acting as cutouts for arms shipments to Cuban exiles for the invasion. This we concluded from putting various pieces of information together. I remember hearing about some CIA people who had somehow helped the right-wing Minutemen in Texas get arms originally intended for the invasion. One of the reasons given for the necessity to do away with Oswald was the difficulty they had with him when he returned. Apparently, he knew the Russians were on to him from the start, and this made him very angry. After one discussion we had, it seemed quite likely that the original assassination project may have been to kill Kennedy and blame it on Oswald, who would be solidly linked to Castro, as a pretext for another invasion attempt or build-up.